The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Host. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethost.com/terms.
Welcome back to Directly Current, the EV Politics and American EV Jobs podcast. I'm your host, Max Patton. I hope you had a wonderful Memorial Day weekend. And on this episode, we're speaking with Toby Krause, the CEO of Lightship. They're making something that fits into perhaps the most classic of all American pastimes, the road trip and being outdoors. Campers and RVs are hugely popular, and as Toby reminds me in this episode, it's actually about 1 in 10 American families that own one. And yet, in the electric age, they've been difficult. That's not to say you can't tow with a Rivian or a Ford F-150 Lightning. They have plenty of torque and they drive really well, but when you're towing something big and heavy with a large aerodynamic profile, your range dips considerably. In fact, on most vehicles, it's about half the range or less when towing a big travel trailer fit for, say, a family of four. That's where Lightship comes in. They're reinventing the idea of a camper by making one that is not just sleek and modern and fitting in with a Tesla or a Rivian aesthetic, but that is actually electric itself. So the auxiliary power system is actually also a traction system. It has a 80 kilowatt hour LFP battery and a motor on its wheels, meaning that it actually propels itself, or at least it assists itself along the highway so that you're not dragging a big trailer, making up for most of the range loss. Also, you can charge it at a fast charging station just like you charge your truck, even at the same time if you're able to park the right way. And Toby and I do talk about that. Lightship is a really cool product. They've had tons of interest. They're building them here in Broomfield, Colorado, very close to where I am. Of course, they're making hardware in the US, and that comes also with the impact of tariffs. So Toby and I discuss a lot of the ongoing tariff policy and the end of subsidies that has gone on. We recorded this well before the IRA's demise in many respects with the bill that's been passed in the House. And by the time you're listening to this, who knows where that is. So please enjoy this story of an American entrepreneur and his team doing something really cool for EVs. All right, Toby Krause, welcome on to Directly Current. Thank you so much for joining us. First thing, big thing with Lightship is a very unique American product you guys are building as this electric-focused RV. It really is in many ways a vehicle itself with the way it's built, the batteries, the powertrain, the things it requires. And you're building in the U.S. First off, I have to ask, obviously, U.S. manufacturing is a hot topic these days, not just for EVs and clean energy, but in general, there's a lot of ongoing tariff policy changes minute by minute. I know you're not quite shipping yet, but I assume it has to be keeping you up at night. So what are some of the big challenges and how are you those with Lightship right now?
Oh man, right out of the gate, the hard hitting questions. I love it. Yeah, they don't tell you when you start a company that you also have to, you have to plan for. It's everything you can control. And then you also have to deal with like global macroeconomic issues. When I started this, I wouldn't think that 4 years later, I was up at night thinking about tariffs, but you're right. That is something that we think a lot about. Look, the good thing for us is, as you said, we're a US-based manufacturer. We proudly manufacture here in Broomfield, Colorado, where I'm speaking to you from. And we also like to say, if we were a car, we would be the most made in America car, meaning not only are we manufactured in the US, but the vast majority of our supply chain is in the US. We're close to 80% in terms of the value of the parts that are going into the vehicle that are US based. I think the number one most made in America car is the Tesla Model Y. It's about 75%. That makes us more resilient to tariffs. But look, we're we rely on a global supply chain. We're doing like a complex product. And the reality is not everything is produced at high quality, reasonable cost in the United States. So there are a few key components that we have to source from elsewhere. And yeah, we have to be pretty vigilant and keep an eye on it.
I imagine. Yeah, I definitely want to get into the cells and some of the electrical nerdiness in a second. But the big thing I imagine is you guys have reservation holders. I assume they put downright deposits for their Lightship. Pricing is, even in the best of times, right, hard to predict years on when you're shipping a really complicated product. Do you anticipate that there's going to be more changes to come? Or are you doing your best to absorb the margin? Obviously, it's a premium product, but I know that must be difficult too. What does that look like?
We don't have any intention of changing pricing. That's what you're getting at. When we started our first chunk of production, we're doing a limited edition Founders series, which is we call it the Cosmos. It's a really awesome, fully spec'd, kind of like threw everything we got at it. And it starts at a higher price point. That has helped us mitigate some of the startup costs of scaling through being a low volume manufacturer. And we're in the midst of starting to sell our serial production products, which we call the Atmos and the Panos. I mean, we are holding to the pricing we have. It's a little bit impossible to predict the future, right? If we come out with 300% tariffs on everything at some point, we are a for-profit company with investors. Like, we have to make money. But yeah, we don't anticipate anything at this time.
Yeah. And I guess you guys do have a little bit more margin because you are building like a very unique kind of product, right? It's aero, it folds down, it's got the integrated solar. And so you're not exactly building like a commodity RV. So in some sense, I guess you guys are doing more innovation stuff that might isolate you from an individual like component, right, being tariffed.
Yeah, I mean, I think a really differentiated product. However, we're building a company and a brand, and we actually want our products to become more accessible over time, not less accessible. So we definitely have to focus on consumer sentiment and what folks are willing to pay.
Yeah, absolutely. And I commend that. The other thing, as you mentioned, it's Broomfield here. I live near Boulder. Love it. A lot of like Rivian drivers, electric truck people here. It's also, Colorado is an interesting state to manufacture in. Was there any kind of state policy or incentive, or what was the kind of rationale behind doing a lot of operations here in Broomfield?
We picked Broomfield. Right? So I grew up in Colorado as well, in Boulder, and I moved back here when I had children. Great place to live. And the company was founded. There's two founders, myself and Ben. And Ben is based in the Bay Area, where I lived and worked for a decade when I had the Tesla, and also spent a chunk of time with Tesla. And then we founded the company. Ben was still in California. I was in Colorado, and it's grown organically ever since. And we've made the best out of both locations. So Colorado is a great place to have, both like attracting like a sort of a diverse workforce, both in terms of like engineers and production associates. It's actually got a really robust ecosystem, and it's also lower cost, at least as compared to the Bay Area when it comes to the footprint of our building. And then the Bay Area has been great for us because a lot, based on the history of electrification, like a lot of really good EV engineers are based in the Bay Area. So we've made use of that too. On the Colorado point though, I have to give Colorado like a little bit of tough love. It is a great place to be and a great place to work, but we don't get any like specific incentive programs from the state. And there are states that are leaning in and being a little bit more aggressive. And I think that's something that Colorado does need to do better if they're going to attract and retain companies like us in the long run.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. We have to get Polis on here at some point, right? Because the consumer side subsidies are really great, but I have been curious, what are the production side things looking like? And not everyone's going to put a production plant in Broomfield or somewhere, but yeah, it still is, I think, really important, given especially how much talent is based here, right? It's not the Bay Area, but there are lots of engineers in various areas here. And like you said, that provides another good place to recruit. People want to live near Denver. And that makes sense. You mentioned this a little bit, the idea of your ex-Tesla, lots of Lightship's team is ex-Tesla, maybe some ex-Rivian, I'm not exactly sure, but you guys have a lot of like automotive industry DNA. How does that inform the product? Because this is, you're marketing this not only to like your Rivian customer, but maybe even someone with a dually or a Ram 1500 who wants to save some fuel, right? This is a kind of a product targeted at a broad category. So are you bringing in people from the traditional RV and towing industry? Is it all like electric startups? Where are you like basing the talent and the company culture off of?
Yeah, so we do have a hefty, I'd say, Tesla contingent here and Rivian. Like our head of creative was the former chief creative officer at Rivian Design, the R&T and the R&S. But we also do have, I'd say, like a diverse group of folks from all over the industry, not just automotive, more traditional car companies, aerospace backgrounds. We have some, I mean, our factory lead ran another production facility for a towable RV, and actually a lot of our production team as well. So we have some RV DNA there as well. It's funny. I think it's coming from Tesla is like a superpower, and it's something that we have to be mindful of. I think we all have developed a really great set of experience in how to build great products and great EVs. But then there's a couple of things. One is, you stated it, like our customers at this point are probably about 50-50 between EV owners and more traditional truck buyers.
Oh, wow.
And we have one of our very first customers is somebody who we listen to a lot and is very passionate about what we're doing. He drives a Ford F-150 hybrid with power boost system. And he's very good at reminding us like what a buyer who doesn't drive an EV needs. And so we have to be able to face both of those customers in an authentic and helpful way. And then I think the other thing, though we come from automotive backgrounds and Tesla, we're in the RV market. And this is like a fundamentally different market. It is an order of, it's massive. 1 in 10 American families owns an RV, but it's an order of magnitude smaller than automotive, which means like the volume, the capital you're going to raise, everything is like an order of magnitude lower. So we can't be automotive about everything, because we can't raise $10 billion like a Rivian to bring the product to market. We have to be pretty thoughtful about how we marry our automotive heritage and like the product and customer we face.
Yeah, though in some senses, like you look at the product, and I encourage people, if they've listened to this podcast since the first time hearing about you, we'll link your website, they should check it out. There's a lot of really automotive style decisions that you can tell are in like your AE1 in the product, right? The fact that it has a heat pump climate system, the fact that it's using automotive grade battery cells and stuff, and the whole idea of an e-axle, right? This isn't like, you're not totally unique in the industry, but in bringing this to the RV industry, like that, I don't think of the RV industry as this like technological frontier, but you guys are bringing that there. So does it help maybe that like Tesla and Rivian and everyone else has built up a supply chain for getting some of these parts off the shelf? Or are you still having to, I guess there's a bit of both, but I imagine you guys still have to do a lot of custom work too to put this into this use case.
Oh yeah. We definitely, I'd say we stand on the shoulders of giants in that there's a reason we can exist today. And it's because we are leveraging the hundreds of billions of dollars that have gone into automotive electrification. And therefore we don't have to reinvent our own like high voltage battery packs or electric motors. So that I think is pretty darn important. And then, I think if you look at like automotive and automotive principles, automotive approach, like that is very helpful for our industry. Like the RV industry is traditionally it's almost like a home building industry, right? Like they're very at building mobile homes out of oftentimes like plywood and sheet metal, and they're good at putting together like interiors, but these are not built to like automotive standards or like automotive durability and test standards. And as we've gotten going, we started as this company that's focused on electrification. What we've learned is purely the automotive development approach in and of itself is really beneficial. Like the way you approach design and test, and the result is a product that is significantly higher quality and can last a lot longer. And that actually is itself, putting the electrification stuff aside, a big value proposition to customers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think it shows you've done some of your video tours and stuff. My former employer, Kyle, I think stood with your co-founder, and you guys talked about the like idea of using like safety glass in certain areas and the components, the recycled PET plastics of building up the interior. I mean, it again, the listeners really for visual aid should look at your site. It is really neat seeing how the interior of this does resemble like a Volvo or a Rivian, if that was a living space, much more so than your traditional RV, which is a different approach. And I imagine like that's also going to be like, you guys have to probably do durability testing for those materials on a totally different cycle than the way they're used in a Rivian, yeah. right? Where someone gets in that one and presumably they're not living in it. So like yeah. it's a little bit different. So I imagine that, is that challenging as well?
It's definitely challenging because, and this gets a part of your last question too, which is, okay, so we do rely on a lot of parts that have been developed for automotive and are taking some things off the shelf, but so much of what we do is a custom application. So we may not have to do really deep component level testing of our motor, for instance, because our motor was designed for a light duty vehicle that's going to go a few hundred thousand miles. And so we can feel really good about that. Now we do have to do a lot of testing on how you use that at a vehicle level in a completely different application in a, what we call our Trek Drive system. And how does that all function at a vehicle level? And then there are a ton of parts like the body or the windows that are like custom for our application. So you can't assume that, oh, because this automotive glass was used in a car somewhere, like that it's just like fine to stand up to like rock chips and like all sorts of other things in our very specific application. So we have a whole team, a test team that is doing all of that. And it is it's a lot. Yeah, it's a lot.
And the next thing I wanted to talk to, this gets at, you were mentioning earlier, right? Half of your customer base are people in combustion trucks or people who aren't driving an electric truck yet, or maybe don't want to. And there's a whole charging equation here, right? Because many of them are going to ship with the Trek Drive, the battery, and the whole integrated power is a huge, it's a huge part of this product. And that does mean that people are going to need to charge it. Now, if you're doing a lake trip, maybe that just means plugging it into a 50 amp outlet at home, but they may be using public charging infrastructure, which right now, you know this, right, as an electric road tripper, pull-through stalls are few and far between. They're being developed. Yep. But like when it comes to getting people on board with charging infrastructure, what are some of the things you're doing? Are you talking with charge point operators about this use case? Because it's still obviously very early days, but I imagine it's going to be hard for people. It's already hard enough as is long distance driving an electric truck. You add another battery source to it, it brings these benefits, but also it's a whole other thing people need to get used to charging and using.
Yeah. Charging is we could spend the next few hours talking about this. There's layers, and it's something that we do think a lot about. In fact, our head of software and controls, name is Troy Neergard, led the charger team at Tesla. He's one of the inventors of the NACS standard. And we have some thoughtful charging people. Think about the light chip. I guess let's talk about a few layers. One is how the products are used. So something that is nice about the RV industry, we like to say that some of the charging infrastructure is already built in, because many times where you're going is an RV campground that does have a 50 amp or 20 amp outlet at the sort of destination. In fact, some of the earliest, before there was any charging network, when the Tesla Roadster was being developed, this is like very early days. It was like right when I started back in 2009. Before that, where test engineers would stop to charge was RV campground, because that was the only place there was. It's nice that we have kind of like destination charging built in. And then we also have to think about charging both when you're at the location, if there isn't infrastructure, and then like en route. So the way we designed the product as first principle is not having to require the customer to charge any more than they already had. So the reason we basically sized the battery and targeted like all of the efficiency and the sort of like performance of the vehicle to a 300-mile range was so that you're not having to stop extra. And then when you are stopping, we use the NACS standard as well, and you charge at the same time as you're charging your vehicle. And then the last layer is, okay, what are the sort of like ergonomics of the charger layout look like? We call it like the charging ballet. And of course, pull-through chargers are the best, and they are becoming a bit more prevalent, though they are not super prevalent. Typically what ends up happening is you'll take like the end stall, and if you see where you check our website, where the charge port is on the light chip, it's designed in a place that makes it easy to charge at the end stall in a charging station. But it really just depends a little bit on the layout. Yeah, it's a whole thing.
Thanks for outlining that a bit, because that's a huge point too, right? The fact that people can charge at their campsite or at their off-road destination, usually that exists for RV infrastructure. There is like one wrinkle on that I want to put in though, that even just as a passenger EV driver, like I've come across that technically, don't ask me how I know, driving through Wyoming, like KOA in some places policy is that they don't want a continuous load. And that maybe is for liability reasons, but they haven't engineered there are things for that yet. And it's not to say that combustion RVs don't use a lot of electricity. I'm not sure how rational or not rational those policies are, but there are little things like that. I imagine, like, in some ways, maybe the campsite operator isn't used to the idea of, oh, here's this spaceship looking RV coming in and they're going to be pulling a continuous 9 kilowatts. Is that something you're also thinking about in the design of this?
Yeah. So typically what's going on there is when you look at campgrounds, their infrastructure, and this, you see this on the light duty EV or like commercial EV side as well. Like at some point you're going to be stressing like the infrastructure, and like there's going to need to be an upgrade, say a transformer or something in the value chain. And most campgrounds can't have like a 50 spot campground couldn't have 50 light chips all charging at once. Like they were probably built to have a handful of motor coaches, even a traditional combustion motor coach, as you, or RV in some cases, as you alluded to, like need to be plugged in because the power draw around like the air conditioner and such that it can't do it without being plugged in. So there is infrastructure upgrades that need to happen. We do a ton of energy management on the side of the lightship for this purpose, so that you can control how much power you're pulling depending on where you are, so you're not tripping breakers and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's another cool part of it, right? Is the software and the integration and the management you guys are doing. And that's the kinds of things that honestly, like even in the automotive sector, Tesla do it, Rivian do it. Not everyone's doing it yet. The fact that you guys are doing it with an RV with this kind of product is really cool. But you mentioned the energy component, right? And then at the beginning of our talk, you also discussed that there's certain components that are definitely more expensive or have to be sourced internationally as opposed to others. I imagine, I don't know, that one of those might be the cells, right, for your pack. You're using an LFP chemistry, which for listeners who don't know, it's like pretty good automotive grade battery chemistry, but it's a bit heavier than NMC. I think for this application, it makes a ton of sense, right? It's cheaper. It's really durable. It's like an 80 kilowatt hour battery. It's basically the size of something you'd see in a crossover or sedan, right? It's a big battery, but I imagine because it's LFP, you may have to source that from overseas. What does that look like?
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. I mean, so we use an LFP battery. What's great about LFP is for a high cycle life application, and where you're not necessarily packaging it in a small passenger vehicle, it's really great. And we want people to be using the lightship, taking it camping as much as they want. And then when they're not using it for camping, it's plugged into their house and doing home backup power. So we're anticipating a lot of throughput in the battery, and LFP is really good for that. LFP, for folks that don't know, I saw a stat somewhere, I might be misquoting it, but I think it's like something like 90% of cells are manufactured in China. And if I'm misstating that stat, I'm not misstating it by much. And LFP in particular is largely produced in China. Yeah, we don't disclose what our battery supplier is, but our battery is one of the items that is currently not produced in the United States. And so we do have to, that's something where we pay attention to like tariffs and trade policy. Now there is an industry of battery suppliers that are like up and coming in the US, and they're all small, but I think we're hopeful. We got some kind of exciting things we're working on with some of those companies. And I think as we go forward, that's something that maybe could change in the future.
Yeah, like the battery is such a fundamental component of the vehicle. I can't imagine it's easy to just swap on a whim, but it sounds like you guys are exploring possibilities because realizing that you do want to be resilient, whether it's tariff policy, whether it's a cell manufacturer changes their mind and produces something else, you do want to have that be in some ways a little bit flexible, right?
Yeah, the battery we use today is awesome. And it comes from a great supplier.
Yeah.
And swapping a battery is non-trivial, but it is possible. And I think like at some level, a company like ours for such a high cost component needs to have like inherent flexibility, right? That's just sort of the nature of the business. It's not because we don't like the battery we use or the supplier that we're getting it from. It's just like, I think that's prudent for supply chain resiliency and managing your cost structure and just good business practice.
Yeah, absolutely. And I imagine it's like one of the most probably expensive line item components in everything, right? You're custom doing a lot of the chassis and everything, but still it can't not be cheap, I imagine. The other thing you mentioned is there's this bi-directional capability. I think that's a really cool idea, because as much as aspirationally I or you or anyone with an RV would love to be camping every weekend with it, real life, that may not be the case. But the idea that you have this thing parked in your driveway or in your garage or wherever, and that you could draw power from it and use it as a big battery store because you're not regularly taking it to the grocery store, I think that's a really neat idea. So just a little bit more on that. I know that's something you guys want to roll out with some software updates, maybe not necessarily at launch, but we've seen like General Motors and Ford have done this in their own large battery electric trucks. And their approach requires a little bit of service work at home, because I believe they output DC essentially. So some people, you need to get a special inverter for your home.
Yeah.
Do you guys have any idea yet at this point how it's going to be implemented in the light chip, like what it would look like plugging into people's homes?
Yeah, we do. Yeah, we have this feature today. And so taking a step back, like this is something we're really excited about, the bi-directional aspect of it. And the reason we're so excited about it is for a few reasons. If you look at a car, much has been said about this as a feature, and you can do it on a number of electric trucks these days, and that's awesome. However, the challenge is if it's in a vehicle, you're likely using that vehicle for other reasons, and you didn't get it as like a backup for your house. So you probably have a situation where you can't guarantee that your truck is in your driveway the moment you want to have backup. On the other hand, a light chip, when you're out traveling and camping, you probably don't need to back up your house. And when it's at your house, it is like fully available. So it's the same technology, but the sort of the use case of the product makes it really interesting. And because RVs are relatively underutilized, it's actually available a lot for this purpose.
Yeah.
So that's why we love it. The way we're doing it, I think are fairly pragmatic about it. Day one, how we're approaching it is using the light chip as effectively like a backup generator. So it's just you're offporting AC power. Can any home that has a transfer switch installed because they have a diesel generator or any type of backup system should be able to use a light chip as like an AC backup source. And if you talk to our customers, like that's sort of like power resiliency, power goes out in Texas or something. That's what's like top of mind for them. And we're really excited about that. There is a second step. And here we want to be ready as this technology becomes more prevalent. You mentioned it. If you're wanting to do a DC offtake from the battery, then there does need to be something that is upgraded on the sort of home side. So you're going to have either a EVSC or like a vehicle charger or some other type of electronics that are allowing you to do that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something we want to support as well, but it's going to take some time for that infrastructure to get out in the wild.
Yeah, I'm glad you guys are thinking about it as a use case, because I think it's so valuable, especially I am assuming a lot of your consumers, especially the ones with EVs, but even maybe the ones who don't, will have solar or some kind of thing in their home, right? They may be environmentally conscious. They may want to just save on their energy bill. So that's a huge boon to this. Last question I want to ask is, this is a beautiful product. It's a premium product nonetheless. And it's a very, like you said, it's a unique product. And because of that, it's not a cheap proposition. And if we make an analog in the vehicle world, like Rivian has the R1T and the R1S, great vehicles.
Yeah.
They'll have great synergy with something like this. But at the same time, I also think of driving an I-70 here. I see Subaru Outbacks towing like a little U-Haul trailer. It's much smaller, not necessarily an RV, but other things like that. And there will be an R2 and R3, and other companies are working on this kind of smaller, cheaper class of electric vehicles. In line with that, I'm not asking you to confirm anything, but what are some of the directions you guys are thinking about when it comes to broadening your technology and maybe making it more affordable in different use cases? It doesn't, maybe not necessarily a full-scale home RV, but also maybe something that mountain bikers or campers or people who are hauling lots of stuff might want to use.
Yeah, that's exactly where we want to go. We haven't announced the sort of next versions of the product beyond what we call the AE platform. What we're selling right now is the AE1. The reason we started where we started is if you look at the RV market, there is a healthy market, a healthy amount of vehicles that are sold in this like class of vehicle. So we started with a family camper. It's 26.5 feet and it's got all the amenities, and our price point that we're starting to sell at now, we will have two versions that are 184 and 151 grand. Which is high price, but is actually right on the sort of market. That's what this sort of type of product sells for. The reason we start there is because we're relatively low volume. We're implementing a ton of new technology. And believe me, like, we're not like raking in the profit dollars. Like, we need to start at a higher price. And this is a little bit of the model that other EV companies have followed. Like, the Tesla started with the Roadster, and starts with the R1 platform. For us, our Model S platform or our R2 platform, like, we haven't announced yet, but we will definitely come down a step in price. And it will be a different, it'll be a different product for a different customer. And and we're trying to make RVing more accessible. So that means lower price point. That means shorter vehicles. That means having something that is towable, not just by a half ton truck or a full size SUV, but getting into something like a 4Runner has like a 5,000 pound tow capacity. The Subaru Outback is a pretty low, that'll be a pretty small RV.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, we definitely want to get down and create products that are increasingly accessible for folks.
Yeah, who knows? Maybe with electric powertrain, there will be more vehicles in that class that can tow greater amounts. Definitely, that's exciting to hear. I imagine, like, scale is going to be a huge thing for you guys. Like you said, you're going into a good part of the market right here, but, like, you're going to be building how many of these a year? Do you know roughly?
We haven't announced, like, our production, like, long-term production volumes, but our current our factory here in Broomfield can do hundreds of vehicles a year, and we do intend to expand beyond that.
Yeah, that's super exciting. I'm super excited for all the reservation holders. I definitely would love to get one at some point. Maybe it'll be that cheaper future product potentially. But thank you so much, Toby, for your time today.
Yeah, it was awesome being on. I really appreciate you talking to me and giving Lightship the spotlight.
That's all for this week on Directly Current. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another very exciting guest in the EV industry. Thank you so much to Toby and all of the team at Lightship for their time and resources in setting up this interview. Really love what they're doing here in Colorado, and I will have to get that cheaper camper once they come out with one. But yeah, he's just one of many entrepreneurs who are trying to employ Americans, engineers, manufacturers, all kinds of high-skilled jobs, and build products in the US. But the current impacts right now of this spending bill, the big beautiful bill as Trump is calling it, are significant. And it's passed the House, it is in the Senate right now, and we are going to be putting a lot of pressure on senators here at the American EV Jobs Alliance. Check out the work we're doing. There's evpolitics.org, we'll link in the description. We're going to be starting a messaging campaign pretty soon here, where if you're in one of the states, the jurisdictions that's, you know, has a lot of jobs at stake, many of them red, affected by this, it's going to automatically find your senator and text them, because we need to impose the political cost of this onto the political class, many of whom I think don't realize or don't understand the pain that is about to befall them. And whether you're a Democrat, whether you're a Republican, you really should be concerned about this, because China is really excited right now about the opportunity cost we might be giving up with this forestalling of so many of the provisions of the Inflation Reduction Act that have enabled all this industry to play out so beautifully so far. It's expensive, but often it is in the beginning of these things. And we firmly believe here that the subsidies initially are necessary for American industry and American jobs. But that's enough of our spiel. Please do subscribe to Directly Current for those future episodes and to look at all the great episodes we've had in our feed. We're going to keep at it this summer, and I'll see you again in 2 weeks. I've been Max Patton. Thanks so much for listening.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn. And you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Host. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethost.com/terms.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.